Glad to have you tonight. If you're visiting with us, we're very happy to have you. We have several visitors with us tonight. We've got some folks from Texarkana. We're glad they're able to join us. And I was in that part of the country down the road about 2 or 3 years ago, I think. I enjoyed my time there, and good to see them again. Appreciate their presence. And all of you, wherever you're from tonight, we're glad you're here tonight. I can die and go to heaven because I had lunch today in the other Murfreesboro, Murfreesboro, Arkansas. So I told my wife, I said, yeah, I'm going to Murfreesboro for lunch. She said, well, come on by the house if you don't get enough. But I got plenty. Sure enjoyed that. Open your Bibles tonight to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. When Paul writes to the Corinthians the second time, he says in this section, he says, therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Some translations render that, let us perfect holiness out of reverence for God. I want you to mark that phrase either in your Bible or in your mind, perfecting holiness out of reverence for God, because I want you to just hold on to that thought, because we're going to come back to it in just a moment. We're going to call his name Greg. And we're going to say that Greg walked to his car and he hit the button on the keypad to unlock the doors and nothing happened. And he hit it again and nothing happened. The door locks didn't work. Now, he was able to take the key and get in the car the old-fashioned way, but when he did, it didn't start. And he noticed that his gas gauge read empty, although he had filled it up just that morning. In fact, Greg saw that there wasn't anything working properly in his car. So they had to take the car and tow it to the dealership. And the mechanic came back with a diagnosis and said to him, Greg, you've got a bad BCM. It stands for the basic control module of the car. It's kind of like the brain of the vehicle. And if it goes bad, there's not anything going to work. Now, Greg could have insisted, I want you to fix my door locks. I want you to fix my remote control. I want you to fix my gas gauge. I want you to fix all of these individual things that aren't working. But Greg was smart enough to know that all of those things were mere symptoms of a much bigger problem. I wonder sometimes when it comes to marriage, I wonder sometimes how often we focus on all the symptoms instead of the basic control module. Here's a young couple, and they come in and they say, well, we need to improve communication one with the other. Well, okay, but you do know that's a symptom. Or somebody else says, we need to get better at handling conflict resolution. Well, okay, but that's a symptom. Another couple says, we need to work on showing appreciation and affection one for the other. Okay, but that's a symptom. And we can spend a lot of time focusing on all of these symptoms. But maybe what we need to do is take a step back and focus on the basic control module. And the basic control module in the marriage of a Christian is a spiritual focus. It is a spiritual motivation. It is 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1. Let us perfect holiness out of reverence for God. I don't know what you think that means, but what I think that means is God first in everything. And here's my question. Is marriage exempt from that? Or is marriage included in that. Let me take a few moments of your evening and share with you some thoughts on the subject of sacred marriage. Sacred marriage. Because I'll tell you what it comes down to. It comes down to this. Either you're going to be a God-centered spouse, or you're going to be a spouse-centered spouse. A spouse-centered spouse will act nice toward her husband as long as he acts nice towards her. A spouse-centered spouse will go out of his way for his wife as long as she remains agreeable and affectionate. But does it ever dawn on us that maybe God requires more than that from us? Paul says in this verse, we are to perfect holiness out of reverence for God. In other words, the number one motivating factor in everything we do, everything, including this very special, albeit brief, earthly relationship called marriage, is reverence and respect for God. I'm not called to love my wife because she's holier than anybody else. I'm not called to love my wife because she always makes me happy. I'm not called to love my wife because things between us every day are always wonderfully ooey and gooey and romantic and all that kind of stuff. It's not it. I am called to love my wife out of reverence for God. Period. 2 Corinthians 7:1. Let us perfect holiness out of reverence for Him. Every decision that I make, every attitude I have, needs to flow from that singular holy motivation. Is this something that honors God? Is this something that pleases Him? So I have to ask myself the question, do I just treat the symptoms in marriage, or do I really work on the basic control module? So let me talk to you about that a little bit. I'm going to give you my favorite marriage quote of all time. My number one favorite marriage quote. Here it is. Remember studying Socrates when you were in school? This one's from Socrates. Listen to this. By all means, get married, said Socrates. If you get a good wife, you'll be happy. If you get a bad wife, you'll become a philosopher. I bet you didn't learn that about Socrates in school, did you? Do you ever think why God didn't design marriage to be easier than it is? I mean, it sounds easy. If you're on the outside looking in, it looks easy. My wife went to a wedding not too long ago, and I didn't go. I don't remember what I was doing. I was probably doing something important, like mowing the grass or changing the air in the tires or something like that, you know. But anyway, I didn't go. She went. So she came back, she was telling me about it. She said, you know, she was going through the receiving line, and there's the bride. And she said, I reached out and I gave Lisa a hug and everything. And she said, Lisa looked at me, and she said, the bride looked at me, and she said, oh, I'm so happy the hard part's over. You can imagine what she said. I think it started with the word, honey. There you go. Any of you admit, will you admit that anybody here watches the Hallmark movie channel? Anybody? You watch Hallmark? Hallmark? You do? Oh, we adopted three children, and the oldest, Leah, 16, and she loves the Hallmark Channel. She just sits there in front of the TV and she watches that, cries, you know, the whole deal, and it's clean and it's good, and so you know, we sit there and she and I watch some stuff. I cover your ears because this is a spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Those romantic comedies on Hallmark are all the same. They do four things. Five if it's in the Christmas. Four things. Number one, a beautiful couple meets under improbable conditions. Secondly, they fall in love. Third, they fall out of love. And fourth, in the final 20 minutes, they fall back in love. The end. And then if it's at Christmas, they kiss at the end and it snows. Every single one of them does that. And they make love and marriage, they make it look so easy. Well, it's not easy. One of the reasons, ladies and gentlemen, it's not easy is because romantic love doesn't have any elasticity. Romantic love can't be stretched very far. Because when you start stretching romantic love, it shatters because romantic love tends to be about me. But mature love, holy love, stretches farther than anybody ever thought that it could. It has to, because when two sinful, selfish people start living together as one, there's gonna be trouble. Unless each of them embrace the higher principle and the higher motivation, and that's reverence for God. Do you ever think that God has a higher purpose for matrimony than two people just living together and sharing the same mailbox? And sharing the same kitchen table and sharing the same bedroom? Do you ever think that maybe it's not your happiness God has in mind as much as it is your holiness? And I'm not saying happiness and holiness are mutually exclusive. I'm not saying that at all. I am saying that when you look at your relationship through the lens of God's purpose, you get a whole new perspective, because suddenly it dawns on you, wait a minute, this marriage thing is not about me. So what is the real purpose? What is the real purpose of marriage? I think the real purpose of marriage is to draw us closer, like a triangle, to draw us closer to the one who brought us together. I hope you understand that your relationship with God is going to outlast your relationship with your spouse. Here's your relationship with your spouse. Here's your relationship with God. That's why just working on the symptoms aren't always going to work very well, not in the long run. Now, you should try to make your home more peaceful and pleasant. There's things you and I can do. We should do those things. You can look for ways to keep the romance alive. You ought to do that. You can show respect to one another and courtesy and kindness. You should do all of those things. But what I'm saying, if your relationship with God isn't right, then you're just sticking Band-Aids on symptoms. The problem is sometimes we look for something in another human being that ultimately and eternally only God can provide. And I think that's why marriage dissatisfaction runs so high. Marriage dissatisfaction, I think, runs so high sometimes because we expect too much. My first computer, and I'm going to date myself. My first computer was an old 486. You ever heard of those? No? Maybe? A little bit? Anybody have an old 486? They had 386s. They had 486. Okay. You're not still using it, are you? What? Barely? No, you're not too far. We were in the Smithsonian a couple years ago, and we're going through there, and they had this thing on technology in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. There was an old 486 computer in there. And my smart aleck son said, "Hey, Dad, look at there. There's your old computer right there. You know you're getting old when your stuff shows up in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. Now, it's like trying to run today's computer programs on an old 486. It's not going to work. It's not that the computer is bad. 486 was a good computer in its day. But to try to get that computer to run today's program, it's not going to work, because you're going to ask it to give more than it can possibly give. Maybe we do that in marriage sometimes. In other words, if you're seeking the largest proportion of your life fulfillment from your spouse, then maybe you're asking too much. Because you and I ultimately were created with an eternal, forever relationship with God. And your wife isn't God, and your husband isn't God. Only God can scratch the eternal itch in your soul. He's the only one who can do that. And here's the amazing thing. When you finally get that figured out, the basic control module, when you finally get that square, then and only then will you come to have a new appreciation for the person, the very special person with whom you have embarked upon this brief earthly journey in marriage. You ever notice how often Scripture connects God's relationship with His people in terms of marriage? Do you ever think about how many times He does that? In Isaiah 62 and verse 5, He talks about, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so God rejoices over you. Matthew 9 and verse 15, when Jesus talked about Himself, Jesus referred to Himself as the bridegroom. In Matthew 22, He compares the kingdom of heaven to a wedding banquet. Revelation 19 and verse 7 talks about the wedding of the Lamb. And the bride, He says, has made herself ready. In the Old Testament, in the prophets, for example, when God talked about the breakdown of spiritual fidelity in Israel, He put it in terms of marital infidelity. Do you know that? Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8. I gave Israel her divorce and I sent her away because she committed adultery. He puts it in marriage terms. Terms that we can understand. And perhaps no place is the sacredness of marriage seen with greater clarity. Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 22, where holy matrimony is holy, because here it is compared to the holy relationship and union between God and His church. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her. Verse 29, no one ever hated his own flesh but nourishes it and cherishes it as Christ does the church. For this reason, a man shall leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. How can you read that and not come away with a higher appreciation for the sacredness of this relationship? How can you read that and not understand why God connects holy with matrimony and how they go together? Look with me in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9. Where Paul writes and he says, therefore we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. Paul said our number one life goal, our number one life ambition, he says, is to live pleasing to our Lord. Now, I'm going to come back to the question I asked at the very beginning. Is marriage exempt from that? Or is marriage included in that? You know, when you get down to the core purpose of marriage, like everything else, that gets even beyond sexual expression and beyond the bearing of children and even beyond companionship, is not what most people think. Most people, or a lot of people, think marriage is about my happiness. And what he's telling us here, the goal of marriage is to live in such a way as to please Him in what we do. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 31, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Is marriage exempt from that? Or would marriage be included in that? And if that's not enough, look at verse 15 here in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 15. He died for all so that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but live for Him. Is marriage exempt from that? Or is marriage included in that? You see, God is demanding me to look at my life and my relationship with my spouse through the lens of His perspective. And what He tells me is that my marriage is not about my happiness and my glory, but God's. What are you doing, He's telling me, what are you doing to honor me with the relationship you have with your wife? If that's not enough, look in verse 18. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 18. Now all these things are from God who reconciled us to Himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. When Paul talks about God gave to us the ministry of reconciliation, I believe Paul is talking specifically about the great commission Jesus gave the apostles to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. I get that. I understand that. But is not the very work of the church, the gospel, is that not the ministry of reconciliation that we take and share the good news with the world? That man can be reconciled to God through the death of Jesus on the cross. He uses the term reconciled or reconciliation twice in verse 18. You say, well, what does that have to do with marriage? Think about it. Think about it. Reconciliation. Reconcilable. Here's a word, irreconcilable. You ever heard that word? Here's two people that can't get along, and so they decide to just call it quits, and they got to give a reason for it. And so it's irreconcilable differences. Interesting choice of words. Here's our point. If your home is fraught with fighting and animosity and distrust and anger and resentment, then guess what just happened? Your marriage has contradicted your message. And if your marriage contradicts your message, then you have sabotaged the very goal of your life. And the goal of your life, back in verse 9, is to live pleasing to Him. And at the same time, to share the message of reconciliation to others. And a marriage that is God-honoring is a relationship that puts a picture of flesh on the very idea of reconciliation. Because a marriage that is God-honoring is going to be a marriage that models forgiveness and selfless love and sacrifice. What do you think are the basis of reconciliation? If it's not forgiveness and selfless love and sacrifice. This hit me one day like a ton of bricks. What we do in our homes with husbands and wives, with one another, is nothing more than a small taste of what God has done and continues to do for us. Forgiveness and selfless love and sacrifice. Your marriage will either be a stumbling block to the gospel or a stepping stone to the gospel. How can I tell my kids that God's promise of reconciliation is secure and strong if they see that their daddy's promises don't mean one thing? Now, there's an exception to that. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, he says, "As far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men." As far as it depends upon you. You learn a hard lesson in life sometimes, and that hard lesson is there's only one person you can control. Only one. And that's you. And if you have a spouse who is bound and determined to be morally unfaithful, you know how much you can do about that? You know what you can do about that? Nothing. Not a thing. because they make their own decisions and they make their own choices, and they'll have to live with the consequences of those. And Jesus talked about that in Matthew 19 and verse 9, where God allows unfaithfulness to break the bonds of sacred marriage, and he allows the innocent one to put away the guilty one. But I am convinced that is not a first response, but a last resort. I heard somebody say one time, they kind of said glibly, they said, "Oh, I just don't think there's any such thing as an innocent party." And I thought about that, and I thought, well, number one, you need to take that up with Jesus himself. But secondly, I think what they mean by that is there's no such thing as a perfect party. And they're absolutely right about that. There's no such thing as a perfect party. There never is, and that's not the issue. The issue is about glorifying God with my life. The issue is asking one question and answering that one question. Whether it is on this subject or any other subject, doesn't make any difference. And the one question is, what does God want me to do? What would he want me to do? And what he would want me to do is to do everything within my power to reconcile, reconciliation. Now, sometimes that's not possible because you can't control another person. And sometimes you have to make hard decisions, especially when spiritual lives hang in the balance. And I understand that, so did Jesus. But my point in all of this is, we live in a society, ladies and gentlemen, where relationships are just discarded with frightening regularity, where people make promises and fail to keep them, where spouse bashing has become a national pastime. And you take some Christians who are working hard to maintain a God-glorifying relationship, don't you know those people command attention in this culture? Our lives, our relationships, our marriages, I don't think we think about it this way. Our marriages become platforms of evangelism to lead others to Jesus Christ. How many of you have been married 25 years? Raise your hand. If you've been married 25 years, don't be bashful. Get them up. 30. Any 30s? 40. She had to look at you. She's looking to see if you raised your hand. 50. Any 50? Wow. 60s. Wow. Good. 70s. I was in a place one time and I'm doing this, and there's a brother sitting way in the back, and he'd throw his hand up every time. That's 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. He'd raise his hand for 100. And I had to stop, and I said, "Brother," I said, "you've been married 100 years?" He said, "No, but it sure feels like it." And I thought to myself, I'd hate to be in his car going home tonight. Wow. Sometimes it's easier for younger people to look at those who've been married a while and think, well, you know, they hadn't gone through all the stuff I had to go through. They maybe had it easier than I've had it. I doubt that. These people who raise their hands are living testimony to the power of God's love, and the power of forgiveness, and the power of grace, and the power of selfless sacrifice, and the power of reconciliation. Let me tell you, that's the basis of the gospel message. That's what the gospel's all about. Now, let me leave you with one more thing to think about that we don't usually think about, and that is when you got married, you married a Christian, you married God's child. All of which says your spouse is not just your spouse. Your spouse is God's daughter. Your spouse is God's son. Your spouse is a child of God. Now, I think all of us understand that if you want to get on the good side of a parent, then you be good to their kids. If you want to make a parent angry, then you pick on the child. You be mean to their child. Be the bully. Watch what happens. You will fire up parental righteous indignation in a hurry. It's the same with God. Zechariah chapter 2 and verse 8 says, he who touches you touches the apple of his eye. God's talking about his people. He says, my people are the apple of my eye. So you married a child of God. So it's not about just me and my attitude toward this other person out here. It's about me and my attitude toward a daughter of the King. You know, we spend time talking about the analogy of the fatherhood of God. Jesus taught us to pray, our Father who art in heaven. Well, extend the analogy a little further. If God is the father of the woman you married, guess what that makes him? In a sense, he becomes your father-in-law. All of which says that when you fail to respect your wife and you demean her and when you mistreat her and speak condescendingly to her, you're courting trouble with your father-in-law. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. God notices. I don't think we realize how passionate God is toward the person who is our spouse. He designed your spouse as a one-of-a-kind person, and he reconciled your spouse to himself through the death of his son on the cross. And that makes your spouse special. We have four biological children, and three are married and grown and have their own families. And one, our youngest, is fixing to get married in about 2 weeks. As soon as I get home, we've got to head towards Kansas City here in a little bit. And he's marrying a wonderful Christian young lady there. And we're excited about that for him. But I'll tell you what. I pray that every one of my children will marry somebody who will love them as much as I do. But at the same time, every one of my kids fall short of perfection. They have quirks. They have limitations. They mess up because their daddy does. So I pray that they'll each have a spouse who will be kind to them and gracious and forgiving and patient. I would cringe to think that any of my children would marry somebody who would be cruel and abusive and mistreat them and hurt them. Now, God is fully aware that your spouse has limitations. God is fully aware that the person to whom you are married has quirks and faults, sins, has messed up. God knows all about that. So he wants you to be as forgiving and patient with their faults as you would want your kids' spouses to be with them. So think about how you treated your spouse, maybe over the last week or so. Is that how you want your son treated by his spouse? Is that how you want your daughter treated by her spouse? You see that ring on your left hand? I'll tell you what that represents. You didn't marry just any man or any woman. You married a daughter of the King. You married a son of the King. And God watches every day how you treat his precious child. Maybe there's some things said tonight, maybe different than what we usually think about when we think about marriage. But I was thinking about that one day, and it just some of these passages just hit me in a whole different way. And I hope it makes us all think. I don't remember the occasion. There was one. There was some celebration that we were doing. Luke was the last one at home. He was probably about 18 then, and he and I decided we'd go out and take the day and we'd play golf and hang out together. And And Julie said, when you guys come home, I'm gonna fix a big supper for you. It's gonna be, you know, I'll really do it up. We'll do dessert, we'll do the whole thing and go have fun. And so we did. When we came back home, she'd fixed a wonderful meal. It was great. And she said, now for dessert, I fixed you a chocolate pie. And it's one of those pies that sat over on the counter, and it was one of those pies that looked fake. The meringue was just whipped up just perfect. And our mouths are watering, you know, and so she's gathering things up, and she walks over there, and she starts cutting that chocolate pie, and she brings it over, and she sets it right in front of me. Now, you have to understand something about my wife. My wife is big on manners and etiquette. And she has taught all of her children, including me, that when the hostess is serving you dessert, it's just polite to wait. Don't just start digging in. Wait until everybody's served and the hostess sits down, and then you can eat and all that kind of thing. So I've got this beautiful piece of chocolate pie right in front of me. So she'd gone back to cut Luke a piece, and I took the tip of my fork and I just put it in a little bit of that chocolate, because I thought, you know, if I just taste a little bit, that doesn't count. So I put a little bit of that chocolate into my mouth, and I tasted that, and I've got to tell you something. That's the awfulest tasting thing I'd ever put in my mouth. It was horrible. And I realized what she did. She didn't put any sugar in it. She left out one key ingredient. Wow, it was bitter. Oh, it was bad. And I started to say something, and I thought, oh, no. I got an 18-year-old boy right here. This is going to be worth the price of admission. And so she served him his piece of chocolate pie, and she got her a piece, and she's coming to the table, and she said, dig in, boys, dig in, eat, eat, eat. And I sat there, I watched him. He took his fork. I mean, he didn't just get a little bit. He got a huge fork full of chocolate pie, and he stuck it in his mouth. And I watched as his cheeks suddenly began to be puffed out. I saw tears coming down his face. And the next thing I know, there was a chocolate explosion all over the place. He couldn't get rid of that stuff fast enough. Well, Julie's mortified. And she thought, what in the world? And so she took a little bite of it, and she said, oh, no. And she grabbed my plate, and she grabbed his plate, and I said, leave it be. And she said, you're not eating that. And I said, leave it alone. Let it be. And I looked at Luke, and I winked. And I took my fork, and I said, do what I do. And I took my fork, and I scraped off the meringue. And I'm here to tell you, my wife makes the best meringue pie you have ever put in your mouth. And I thought, marriage is a lot like that. Marriage isn't always like the Hallmark movie channel. Every day is not always going to be sweet. There's going to be some tough times. There's going to be some ups and some downs. There's going to be some hard days. But if your focus is right, and you understand that you're to glorify God in this relationship, then you can work through anything. May God help our marriages, our relationships to be strong. May God help our families to be a picture of what the gospel is really all about. We sing the song of invitation tonight. If you need to respond and obey the gospel, don't put it off. Why don't you just do what you need to do? Be baptized for the remission of your sins, and you become a child of the King. Can we help you tonight? Won't you come while we stand and sing?